Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm your host, Willem Vanderhorst. For anybody not familiar with it, in the show I have conversations and interviews with professionals in a pretty wide variety of fields, essentially places and people I'm really interested in learning about. It tends to be around marketing and advertising and media a lot because I'm a marketing and brand strategist, so I help brands, large brands mostly, but not only, small to medium businesses as well, understand how best to communicate with their audience and better understand how people perceive them. What are the different aspects that make up how a brand is understood by people, and what are the actions that make a brand more valuable, less valuable? I mean, there's a bunch of different stuff that go into that. But the other area I'm very interested in is that I'm a gamer, particularly a tabletop gamer, but not only. I'm really interested in the storytelling, the narrative, and that's why, and one of the reasons I was very excited about meeting the people at Fail Better Games today. So I interview game designers for the podcast as well. And people familiar will know that, of course. Now, if you're familiar with this, and if you've already listened to my show, you're going to know this is the part where I generally ask you to give the show a rating, a review in iTunes, if you enjoy listening to it. And I say iTunes because that's the biggest place where people mostly listen to podcasts. And I say iTunes but this could mean the podcast application that you have on your iPhone. That also is the same as integrated with iTunes. And I say this in pretty much every single episode. I'm probably going to keep saying that in every single episode because it makes a massive difference if you actually take time to give us a rating or review. I say us, but it's me, really. And looking at my statistics, I'm quite happy. You know, I don't have a huge audience, but it's growing, and I'm happy that it's growing. And I've noticed that a lot more people are downloading the show and different episodes of the show than ever reviewing the show. So I work in marketing, so I know the ratios for this type of stuff are pretty low, and you know, I'm not expecting a huge percentage of people to take the time to do that. But I wanted to remind you, in case you have a doubt, if you are listening to me right now, you're listening to this via an iPhone podcast application, or any other application you're listening to your podcast through. If you're listening to the iPhone podcast application, it means you're using iTunes. If you're listening to another podcast application, you probably have some other way of giving a thumbs up or a review or something. And what I mean is that I'm actually talking to you personally. I'm really talking to you. That's the whole idea of a podcast. And one thing that I enjoy in my podcast is I have the straight experience of the people talking to me directly, right? Now, I mean it. Like, it would be awesome if you appreciate and enjoy the show, if you could take a couple of minutes to give us a rating and review. Give me a rating and review. I would really, really enormously appreciate. And if you've already done that, sorry for pestering. Just tell your other friend who listens to give me a rating or review. If enough come through, I might stop. And then I'll talk about something else. But we're not there yet. So, if you really consciously don't want to give the show a rating or review, I'd love to know why. Now, of course, it's ironic because the people unlikely to leave a rating or review are probably unlikely to get in touch with me too. But that said, prove me wrong, you know? Don't forget, you can also find a lot more ice cream stuff, all my background, experience, how to get in touch with me. If ever you want brand advice, I can do that, or marketing advice. You can also find the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter, which is a long-form story I write every week at the moment, on my main website. And that's all of this is at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out, icecreamforeveryone.net at the end. And you can find Ice Cream for Everyone on Facebook. Just, you know, type in Ice Cream for Everyone, the same as you did for finding the podcast. You can like the page. That'd be really cool. And that's about it for now. We're back in the gaming area, as I said, with this episode. And I made my way to lovely Greenwich in London. I hadn't been to Greenwich for ages since I left London. It's such a beautiful part of the city, right on the Thames. They have a beautiful office. I met with a team at Fail Better Games, Alexis Kennedy, who's the founder and one of the two founders, and Kash Dukria, one of the writers for Fail Better Games. They recently moved to a brand new office in a converted church hall that they talk about right near the river. And they're an indie game development studio known for their storytelling, narrative games. The main one, the core game that they're very known for, is Fallen London. That used to be called Echo Bazaar. I used to play Echo when it was called Echo Bazaar, when it just came out late 2009, early 2010, before I left for Asia. And they have another game, which is in the same fictional kind of Victorian Gothic London-esque world called The Sunless Sea. Well, the world is called Fallen London. Sunless Sea is another game they have inside of that. So we talk about all of that, the inspiration, where the game comes from, how it was made. And there's a big opportunity. They just released the mobile iPhone iOS version of Fallen London last week. So that was a great opportunity to be able to talk to them about their games, their inspiration, the different games they played, the tabletop role-playing games they've played as well, what inspires them to write stories for Fallen London. And they're a very small and busy studio, so Alexis only had time for about half of the interview, and he had to go in the middle, and then I finished the conversation with Cash. But both, I mean, they're both fantastic, and thank you so much for their time. I mean, thank you so much for your time if you're listening to this, Alexis and Cash. There's a tiny bit of swearing in the episode, so just fair warning, be mindful maybe if there's children around. And that's about it for an intro right now, so enjoy. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I am joined with Alexis and Cash from Fail Better Games. Thank you so much for making some time. Really appreciate it.
Really pleasure.
You just moved to a funky new building, right?
We have. We are now in an 1895 Open Brethren Chapel. The Open Brethren were really interesting. They were sort of a decentralized set of sects of non-conformist types who had sort of broadly shared things. And there was this bizarre, arcane rationale they have for making women covering their heads in church, which is way more elaborate than any theological argument I've ever seen. And I did try to make our editor cover her head in the church, and then she punched me and threw me to the ground. So I read that again.
So just for a little bit of context, Alexis, you founded Fail Better Games.
I did.
And Cash, you joined as a writer recently, right?
That's correct.
About a year ago. Yes. So we'll go into that in a little bit more detail, of course. But it's funny, most of the time I have my interviews one-on-one, so it's interesting to start a panel, but we'll see exactly how it goes. So just going back to the beginning, like, where are you from, Alexis?
I grew up in Oxford. I was born in Germany, and I've lived all over the world. I started out being an English teacher, so I taught EFL. Then I sort of reinvented myself as a software developer, and so I ended up making computer games, which are very language and text heavy.
Yeah.
So it almost looks like it was planned in retrospect. It was largely accidental.
Yeah. Were you already writing before?
Yes. I mean, teacher? Obviously many more people are writing than ever make a living from writing.
Sure.
So I was trying to get novels published. I was trying to design games. And it's not until I actually took 6 months off work. At the time I was working as a technical consultant for a company that did financial software.
Mm.
And this was 2009 when the crash happened.
Mm.
They were suddenly very willing to let a consultant take a 6-month unpaid sabbatical to do crazy unexpected things.
Yeah.
So it's not until I went into it full time that I was able to make a living.
Yeah. And the games inspiration, did you have any kind of games you were trying to design at the time? Video games, board games, or where did you start in terms of gaming yourself?
In terms of the games I liked, in terms of the games I wanted to
do. Games you like, and then, well, both actually.
So, I am omnivorous. I tend to like big, sprawling, complicated games.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to like games with elegant core mechanics. I like a lot of strategy games. I went through quite a serious RTS phase. And obviously, I like a lot of story-driven games too.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people in my generation, I grew up with everything from Fighting Fantasy Gameworks to the Level 9 and Infocom Partner Adventures. And those are always there in my mind. One of the big influences as well was a game called King of Dragon Pass, which showed the virtuous ways in which strategy and story can be combined. So games which are heavy on strategy, games which are heavy on story, games where you really got to get down into the world that they created, put it over you like a duvet and roll around.
Yeah.
Those are the things that I'm always enjoying. Yeah. I think all of those things are visible in Fallen London.
Yeah.
Plus, of course, I was a tabletop role player for many years, and a lot of people have said they can see that in the DNA of Fallen London.
I was going to ask you that, because I'm a tabletop role player as well, and I interview game designers from the tabletop RPG world as well. Did you have a favourite at the time? Or?
A lot of homebrew stuff. Yeah. I was always very fond of Ars Magica. I think that was the last sort of system game I played. It was mostly homebrew.
And you mostly as a player or a game master?
Mostly as a GM.
GM, yeah.
And I haven't... This was the thing, actually. One of the reasons I gave up tabletop role playing was that I realized that I was getting my creative jollies by GMing. And if I actually wanted to do something for a living, then I needed to stop doing that and focus on making games and writing. So I miss it occasionally, but I get the same sort of satisfaction from making games that tens of thousands of people play.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm pleased to see that a lot of the studio tabletop role players, and a lot of people have actually come to tabletop role playing since they started, with this sort of general atmosphere of creative engagement and conceptual storytelling, I think is something that sits at the core of our game. So it's something that sort of goes back into the team.
Yeah, cool. How about you, Cash? Where are you from?
I'm from the United States of America. I was born in D.C.
D.C.?
I was born in D.C., 8 years there, two in Texas, the rest in Florida, about 13 years there, and schooling up in New York.
Were your parents moving around? Or?
Yes, my father was moved around for his work. He was a lawyer with the government.
Okay. Yes. Well, and what led you over to London then? So
Failbetter did.
I
moved here for that job. After I graduated college last year, it wasn't last year. It was 2 years ago by this point. I suppose time has gone swiftly. I was in need of a job, of course. I was in a very fortunate position where I was able to stay at home for about a year's time to get figured out what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I needed to figure out how I could make that work.
Yeah.
I had studied writing in college, or I had studied things which would go into writing, literature, philosophy, history, etc. And quite fortunately, one of my dear friends that I had met my final semester got me to playing Fall in London. And that was just a couple of months before they announced that they would be hiring a writer. So I needed to get two games published and written and altogether done. So I dedicated all of my energies for a month and a half to doing that. And I went through this.
Were you already like a gamer?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I've been playing games since about as long as I could.
Do you have like a go-to reference or one that really has you've got strong memories associated with?
It's hard to say. I suppose if I have anything that I particularly recall in childhood, it would be either The Legend of Zelda, probably Ocarina of Time, or Majora's Mask. Super Smash Brothers was probably one of the big ones. Mario Kart was the first game I owned. Mario Kart was the N64.
On the N64.
Yes, and cool. Pokemon, of course. So yeah. A child of my generation in that regard.
Brilliant. Thanks. So the main game that Failbetter is known for is Fallen London. It used to be called Echo Bazaar as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which one did you... Can you give us a bit of an overview for all the people listening who might not know about it?
Yes. So, as you know, in 1861, London was stolen by bats. It was dragged down a mile below the earth, and it was set down rather ungently on the shores of a vast underground sea, the Untersee. Life goes on there, or life went on there for another 30 years. This is a much neglected period in our nation's history. There's been very little written about it, so we felt we really ought to bring it to light. So the actual experience of exploring Fallen London, it's a slow-paced but enormous and very content-rich game of exploration, debauchery, murder, espionage, intrigue, and where you are a ne'er-do-well in a nocturnal gothic metropolis full of like-minded souls, devils, urchins, rubbery men, a giant alien space bats, although that's a spoiler, and so forth. And there's well over 1.5 million words there, and we are adding content every month. So without fail, we have a substantial additional story going out every month for subscribers and gyps of more content. Yeah. We just keep on adding to it. It's like a coral reef.
Yeah. I remember it was quite popular amongst friends when I, just before I left Asia, so from London to Asia, so I played for much of 2010 at the time. And it kind of like dropped off after I moved to London. The way I remember it, and I don't know if it evolved, but you have a certain number of actions that you can go to, and And you like get involved into different stories, and stories are branching out, and you follow these little threads with your character evolving. And a lot of it at the time was tied to communicating with other people via Twitter or via Facebook. Is that still the case?
Up to a point. There's a multiplayer element which you can ignore completely if you want to. There's nothing core in the game that you need to get to. There's no like in-game raid content in Fallen London. We do find a lot of people engage in a sort of minimal way socially with other people. They just invite them around to dinner in the game, or have cups of coffee with them, or have chess matches with them. And that gives a little bit of an in-game bonus and means that people are there when you need them.
Yeah.
So mostly single player.
Mostly single player. So was it like they gave the opportunity for players to be social, but they didn't really pick it up that much? Or is it just the way...
Honestly, it's because I'm an introvert. I made the kind of game that I would want to play.
Yeah, sure.
And I put social stuff in there because it seemed interesting, and because I had a general idea that's proven to be true, that if you want people to stick around, getting to talk to other people is a good idea.
Yeah.
Because they have more fun and the other people drag them back in the game. But I've... One of the very different things about Fallen London, it is a free-to-play game, but our producer describes it as courteous free-to-play, which I think is exactly right. You can play the whole game and never get a pop-up saying, hey, there's a special on gold sales this week. Do you want to spend $90 on 2,000 gold rather than $90 on 3,000 gold? You can explore nearly all of the game without spending any money at all. Obviously, we'd like you to spend money.
Yeah.
And obviously, there is some really good stuff locked away as premium content that we ask people to pay for if they want to. But there's easily a million words in there that you can get at free and without talking to anybody else. Those other things are bolt-ons. And we've never made as much money out of it as we could because of that, but we just weren't comfortable with going that route, so we haven't gone that route.
Right. And from a commercial perspective, so like this is the main brand that you're known for in terms of gaming. And did you, you produced another video game afterwards in the same universe called Sunless Sea that was partially or totally crowdfunded. I don't know exactly, but, and are there projects that you do from the, that might be more like, I don't know, consulting or creating games for other people that it's more kind of money makers?
We used to. So the history of the company is this, my co-founder Paul and I built Forward London. I did the coding and the writing, he did the art. And never made very much money. So we started taking on bits of client work to pay the bills.
Yeah.
And we did some projects which we're really proud of. We worked with BBC, we worked with Channel 4, we did a game for The Last Port with BioWare as a sort of interquel for Dragon Age 2, Dragon Age 3. And we build ourselves a name, but client work is really difficult, especially if you're a small company without a new business department. And client work always has to take priority over your own IP.
Yeah.
We tried also to make our tools into a platform that other people would use, and that was quite an ill-conceived project. I made lots of mistakes about the kind of tools I thought people would find useful. So we kind of struggled on really hand-to-mouth for 3-4 years. And then the client work dried up, Fallen London just wasn't making any money, and out of the 7 employees in the company, I had to lay off 3. And we were slowly watching the bank balance dwindle towards 0. And I thought, fuck it, we've never made an actual video game. We did have run a couple of small Kickstarters, one of which was quite successful for other projects. We'll give it a try. So we prototyped a Unity game to make sure that we could do what we promised. We set it in the same world because we worked out by then that people really liked Fallen London. We reached out to our community and we crossed our fingers and launched the Kickstarter. And I found the other day the IM message in which I said to my co-founder, you know, I've got this crazy idea that probably won't work, but... And it really worked out.
Yeah.
And the reason it really worked out is that all the time that we had not been making very much money, we had been building a community and we had been building a reputation.
Yeah.
And when we needed help, the community came to our aid.
Yeah.
And people knew that we could do the kind of storytelling and the kind of experience that we delivered in Fallen London, and loved the idea of it being in a video game. So when he asked earlier if it was wholly or partly crowdfunded,
We raised 100 grand through Fortnite, very respectable for a small team.
Yeah.
And then we launched an early access, and it did really well in early access. Again, you know, for a small team, it's not an Undertale size success, but Son of Sea sold to date over 350,000 copies, I'm extremely happy with.
Is that mostly via Steam or?
Yes, Steam don't like us going into detail about exact proportions, but Steam. But Steam is ever is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Yeah. So yeah, we sell most of it through Steam. And the other thing is, we found that when we started selling copies of Sun at Sea, people started getting interested in Four in London. Yeah. Revenue from Four in London literally doubled overnight when Sun at Sea went live. So now our strategy is to keep on making games in the same universe and make sure that we have something for everyone. So people who like premium games can play premium games. People who like the idea of a slower play, free-to-play game, so that can interest them. Some people will want both, and other projects will adopt different models again.
Yeah. And right now, this week, you're in the middle of a big launch. Just launched, right? So
yeah. So this is the mobile version of Four in London. Because I'm not as clever as I think I am, back in 2009, I didn't realise that mobile was going to be the coming thing. Mm. And I was a web developer. That was my skill set. So I made Four in London a browser game. And then we spent 5 years with people saying, this really slow, really text-heavy, minimally graphical game, it would work really well on mobile, wouldn't it? And I would say, yep. And they say, so why isn't it on mobile? And they say, well, for all these technical reasons, we just don't have just be too big a project to port it. And it was the case. But what happened was, just before we started getting successful, Jason Kapalka, who's one of the co-founders of PopCap, who made Peggle and Plants vs. Zombies and a bunch of other stuff.
Right.
Jason's moved on. He left PopCap now and sold the company to EA. But he's a former London fan, and we were chatting to him, and he said it should be on mobile. And we said, yes, it should be on mobile, but it's difficult to be there. He said, well, you know, I really like the game. I wish I could have it on my phone. Would you like some investment money to try to make it? And we said, yeah, I guess. So that gave us the push we needed to get started. And the projects turned out to be substantially more complicated for a variety of technical reasons than we expected.
Yeah, I was at a talk at the Trade Association for Games where one of your team members talked about some of the challenges for porting the game to mobile.
That was lovely.
I was going to ask you about that because that was really interesting. Because it's a live game, and as you said, there's content, storylines, writing added constantly. So what were some of the challenges for porting it? Like, this is a live beast that you have to bring over to another platform, right?
Yeah, so Cash can talk about some of the challenges with the content.
Sure.
I mean, I think a distinct, but from a technical point of view, the porting a game that's been live for a long time is always more difficult than you think. Because it's easy to say, just make it like that other thing.
Yeah.
But actually, like that other thing is a really bad, woolly spec. And writing a spec for a game that has been growing and adding features for 6 years is a hell of a job. So there's that basic thing that's just hard to begin with. Second thing is the usability was a tremendous challenge because everything we build into the browser game is designed to work on desktop-sized screen. Mm. And it's a very, as I said earlier, I like games that sort of you can roll around in. And Four in London is a big sporty game and, you know, a mobile screen. It's not a big environment. So we did a lot of work around UI and UX to try to make sure they fit in. That was a real challenge.
Yeah, for anybody, the user experience and user interface. Yeah. Yeah, just making sure.
And the third biggest thing was Four in London was always designed to be a dumb client web browser game where everything happens on the server. We knew we needed to be able to support at least limited offline play on the browser. But on the mobile version.
Yeah.
But we realised as well that people would want to switch back and forth between the mobile and the browser version. We needed to be able to sync intelligently between the two. So just getting the syncing working in a reasonably secure way was a challenge in itself, and trying to find ways that made sense, that people could understand the way their progress was saved and maintained, and then make those work. That was another challenge. So those three things are the most difficult bits.
And as for content, the follow-up is always adding content. Every month, as it said, we have what are called exceptional stories that come out, a bit of content for our premium players. And in addition to that, we're always making minor updates to the game. We've recently begun what we call the Connected Rebound revamp, where at present the players are able to manifest relationships with all number of factions across Hollandland. You have the Devils in Hell, you have the Church, you have the Urchins, Thieves, Dockers, the Masters themselves, etc. And right now that has just been measured by a single quality, which is connected, how connected you are to this group. And that represents anything from how well they know you to how many favors they might owe you. And that has created a challenge of how we could use that in content sensibly. So we began a lengthy process of breaking that down into two qualities. Connected is now renown and favors. And that's been an ongoing process. So there's always something on the table, content-wise, for Paul Wanda, that we need to get to the players, need to get updated. And making sure, too, as Alexa said, that the progress between a character's adventure on the mobile app and what they're doing on the browser are synced and together. And continuous is a rather difficult
challenge. Yeah, I can imagine. But now it's out and people can download it on for Apple, for iPhone, iOS, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just on iOS for the moment. We get a lot of questions about an Android version, and we have a link which perhaps you can provide with your podcast, where we encourage people to sign up and indicate interest in an Android version.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
So
I'll put all the links to everything we're talking about in the show notes, including the page for expressing interest as an Android user.
Wonderful.
Which I would add my own address because
And both Cash and me are Android users.
We are,
but just because the fragmentation in the Android market is so much greater, we were with iOS to begin with until we could prove the product.
Yeah. And back to the storyline and the environment of the game, which, as we talked about, is very popular. Was that coming from you, the whole Victorian Gothic environment?
Initially, yes. So this is a really odd genesis. What I first wanted to do when I first started looking at a game, I wanted to do a Twitter-based game.
Yeah.
Because at that point, Twitter was this new, odd thing that looked like it might become a games platform. Of course, it never did. And I had this idea around predicting what people were going to say on Twitter and forming kind of syndicates to guess what they might say on Twitter.
Okay.
And being able to portray the syndicates rather than the points. And then I wanted a bunch of power-ups. And because the game was all about listening and guessing words and things, all the power-ups that I got pulled to draw icons for were things like a tree that ears grew on, or a castle made of jawbones, or, you know. And over 2 or 3 weeks, I got much less interested in the whole original idea of the game, and much more interested in the story that started emerging from the power-ups, which was a kind of nocturnal, gothic, goblin markety sort of context. And every time I tried to explain this to people, they went, "Goo." So in the end, I said, well, actually, maybe it could just be a subterranean version of London, but London has actually been stolen and taken somewhere unexpected, and also there. And we'll forget about the whole Twitter thing.
Yeah.
The only message of that is that you used to have to log into the game through Twitter initially. And the game was called Echo Bazaar because originally there was this idea it was going to be around purchasing and betting on things that people said on Twitter, where the Echo Bazaar came from. But that again evolved into being a core part of the game story. The Echo Bazaar is this spired crustacean semi-living entity at the heart of London that's responsible for its fall. We changed the name from Echo Bazaar to Fallen London 2 years in, but it's plainly a much better name.
Yeah, yeah. cool. And I had this idea because there's so many branching out stories, or I can only imagine you're talking about 1.5 million words in the game. How do you manage all of that? Do you have like a secret gigantic sort of mind map that shows all the threads that are happening?
So first of all, it's worth saying it's not exactly branching.
Okay.
There are choices you make at every stage, but the way the game is built is you go into what we call a story loop, a little bundle of choices. You make a choice, it changes state in your character, and then it opens up different story loops over time. Trying to make a branching game with 1.5 million words that you could operate in, where you could operate an exploratory mode and play all of it in any order. Very, very hard to do.
Yeah.
So we get things chunked into manageable elements. But yes, even so, it is a challenge and it gets more and more a challenge. It's like when you're building a snowball, you can roll a snowball only so big and then bits start dropping off it. From that point on, you need to kind of pack snow carefully onto the outside to maintain its integrity. But Cash can talk a bit about the actual
absolutely
detail of what we do.
A last question before you go, just because it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. Yeah. What's Fallen London's favourite ice cream flavour?
Oh, the thing about being in subterranean is that most of the foods have fungal alternatives.
Mm.
So I think we're probably talking about puffball ice cream. Anybody who plays for in London, they know what I'm talking about. If I say the Irrigal ice cream is delicious, people never remember what it was.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for
your time. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. All right. So let's track back. So like you're telling us about your studies and
yes.
So where did you study?
I studied at a Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, New York, just about 15 minutes maybe or so outside the city.
And that was what, English writing, something like that?
Well, I went there to study writing. I knew I wanted to be a writer, and I was extraordinarily lucky to have as my don, my sort of academic advisor, one of my first professors, Melvin Bouquet was his name. Is his name. And he said, Cash, if you want to be a writer, you know, you've taken my writing class, so fine, that's great. But study the things that will make up your writing. If you just study the craft, then you need something more to say. And he was asked the best advice I've been given in some time. So I went ahead and I studied, as I mentioned, history, philosophy, literature, and so on, and things which I try and incorporate and draw upon whenever I am drafting a story or
doing. And what kind of stuff were you writing? So do you tend to write fiction stories beforehand or like right now?
Well, in college, I stuck mostly to my papers as had been prescribed. Sure. And when I got out, my hope had been to be a novelist for some time. Again,
good. I still have that kind of aspirations as well.
I had no idea how that would actually work. One of my professors suggested that I actually take up being a butcher as a supplement to this, just a way to make money and to live a comfortable life. Apparently they do quite well.
I've heard the same thing. And in France, as I said, I grew up, I mentioned beforehand, but I grew up in France and butchers, they're getting more popular. They do earn a good living. Bakers, butchers. Was that what he meant? Or was he being facetious?
No, I think she meant it quite earnestly. That's not a problem at all. But I'd always wanted to be a writer, and I had done some earlier works in high school, which I have not looked back upon.
Yeah.
Don't need to, but I...
Did you tend to write, any genre in particular?
No, I've always rather bounced between genre. I've never felt particularly... drawn to quality isn't bound by genre.
Yeah, but you weren't thinking about games at the time.
Not necessarily. That was a rather lucky development. I don't know why it never crossed my mind. Maybe I had thought of writing a visual novel at one point or another. I'd always had an interest in branching literature. I had a few game books as well. I think the Goosebumps series had a...
Did it?
Yeah.
We're talking about games that you're...
choose your own adventure.
Choose your own adventure.
And I think that was one of my first exposures to that. I had known about it through the Aether yeah. absorbed it.
Did you come across tabletop role-playing games at all?
Yes, yeah. indeed I did. It's something I had wanted to do for a very long time, and I stuck my toe into it in high school with a couple of friends of mine who weren't altogether interested in they were happy to break the game and seduce whoever they came across and, you know,
yeah.
make pelts out of it. So it was an interesting challenge to keep that going. Yeah, but I've played on both sides equally as a GM and as a player.
Favorite games or systems?
I think my favorite system probably is the Fate system.
Yeah.
Which allows, I think, for more storytelling than most of the other ones.
Yeah, I'm still just getting into it right now. I had, while I was in Asia, I didn't really play much RPGs, and I got back into it last year, and I participated also in another podcast with friends in France, specifically about RPGs and RPG theory. Les Voix d'Altaride, hello Julien, if you're listening to this. Fate is, I'm really, really interested in that kind of system. I just got have you heard of a game called Mindjammer?
I think I've heard of it, but I don't know too much about it.
Yeah, so I just got that out of a Kickstarter. It's a transhuman sci-fi game, like based on Fate, and with a really, really beautiful background, like a huge amount of universe world building, and
cool.
I just started reading it.
Well, it was Bulldogs in the Fate system, which is more of a rough and tough and rumble science fiction fantasy.
Where you play with, like, kind of...
I was playing... I was the one human character by strange chance, and it was a strange adventures across the universe.
Is it meant to be like a set of rough, just
more oddball, outcast
type thing?
I it was rather open in what you could do.
Mm-hmm.
My GM Robert Bohr, he had a wonderful story where we were ultimately hopping dimensions and searching for this strange candlewick collective and trying to stop everything from being torn apart without getting too much into it. But.
Yeah, sure. There's always one of the conversations that comes back in the world of tabletop role-playing, and it's interesting in the context of Fail Better being a narrative and storytelling game. So, you know, we're talking about stories. On the spectrum between a lot of preparation for your game or improvising, where would you place yourself? Like as a game master, do you tend to do a lot of improvisation? Do you tend to prepare your story in advance and like your players are going through it?
Or? It depends on the group. Yeah. The one I mentioned, my high school friends, I had a vague outline because I knew however much I tried to keep them on the track and keep them interested in going towards one way, it was going to be a crapshoot as to whether or not that would manifest. Mm. I had another group in college who I played with, and they were much more invested, and so I was able to do more in the way of preparation. But as with everything, I think it depends on the circumstances as to what would be the ideal way to go about it.
Mm. Cool. Completely different topic, but I had to ask about your name, because it was given to me. Cash? Well, Cash de Cria?
Cash de Cria, yes.
That's your actual name, or
my full name is Robert Cash de Cure. Cash is my middle name.
Okay, cool. I was wondering if that was a pen name.
No. I've been called that since my birth. It was a family name. My great grandfather, that was his name. And if you go up the tree, family tree, a little bit off to the side and then down, you get to Johnny Cash. And,
yeah.
So, but yes.
It's a pretty amazing name.
Well, thank you.
It's very cool. I'm sure you've heard a lot of different references, but it did make me think of some kind of cabaret name.
That would not be the worst thing. Not mind that.
Yeah. So you talked about the fact that once you found out about the fact that Fail Better were looking for a writer, and I guess they were requesting a couple of games on a portfolio to be able to show what you did.
Indeed.
And you worked on those two games. What were the games and did you...
The two games were The Tales of the Moon Princess, mm-hmm. which was a quasi-retelling of the bamboo cutter. You know, the ancient Japanese folktale of there's a bamboo cutter, an old man with his wife who, as most old men and the wives... in fairy tales are childless, but very much like a child. He goes into the bamboo grove, cuts open a stalk, and lo and behold, there's this tiny little baby girl on there, and he takes her, and it's a miracle, and they have a child, and she quickly grows and blossoms into this beautiful, beautiful girl. Long story short, turns out she's the princess of the moon, who, for one reason or another, depending on the telling of the story, was sent down to Earth, and in the end, quite sadly, has to leave her loving parents and return. In my telling of it, it was sort of a fusion between that and more of a Chinese aesthetic, wherein you are more of a heroic bamboo cutter, not an old man, but you're out in the woods and you happen to find the moon princess. You know, she's already a small child. And you go on this very long series of events over some 20 years, it's foretold, to get her from the village where she fell to the Heaven's Gate mountain, where she will finally ascend. It was a game built in Twine, so that was really a branching narrative. Right. I did not have the...
So in the same way as a Choose Your Own Adventure. So you had like the text and there was a few different choices. And,
indeed. Right. So the way it worked was you would read the text. You would see a number of options you could respond to that text with. So you meet a tiger in the woods. You have this little girl in your arm. Mm-hmm. How do you defend against it? Do you use trickery to run? Do you beat it? Do you just try and bolt?
Yeah. And for those listening who don't know, and actually I have to admit, like, I've been keeping hearing about it. It's on my list of things to look at, but I haven't really looked at Twine that much. Can you just explain what Twine is a little bit?
I could try. I may not be the best one. That was my first foray into Twine.
Yeah.
Or my second one, actually.
It's just for the basics, really.
But the basics are, so you have little boxes, and this is the way I
use it. So it's a writing software.
So it's a writing software. So you'll have a little box, and you will enter your text, and then in addition to that, you will highlight some key words or phrases which you want the player to be able to click on. And then these will directly link you to another set, another little box, which has, again, a few key choices. And then that keeps moving, and you form this gigantic web.
So it's a bit like a writing as a mind mapping tool?
I suppose so, yes.
Okay.
There are more layers to it, but I, at that time, did not happen to get into them.
And it tends to be used for people writing video games, or also...
Sometimes. As far as I know, it's primarily used to create pieces of interactive fiction, yes.
Okay, cool. Great. All right, so how about the second game?
Well, the second game was a wild romp through a pleasure hotel empire on the moon called Mandala, which was... a fun piece, I like to think. I had done a piece of flash fiction. You know, I had a competition I was in. I was given a small prompt. And I wrote this sort of bizarre story about this... The moon, again, you look up at the moon from the Earth, and it's this mandala. It's this giant, beautiful neon flower.
Wow.
And this is now a pleasure hotel run by Biznok, who's this very shady... sort of crime boss man, and you're playing one of his primary associates. When he has a problem, and he has many problems, he calls you in to fix them. And there is an assassin somewhere in the hotel, somewhere on the whole surface of the moon, and you are brought in to try and figure out who it is and how to stop them. They're a doppelganger as well. They shapeshift consistently, so it's a matter of finding out what they want, trying to figure out where the best places to hide are, and building allies and bringing him down accordingly.
Fantastic. Cool. It sounds like fun. And so now you're working as a writer. Can you tell us a little bit about the day-to-day? Like, are you picking up on whatever storylines are going on, and or you organize? I don't know how much you can talk about how it's organized.
I think I can talk a good deal about that. We have a very fine, very detailed content pipeline.
Mm.
So right now I'm primarily working between two pieces. One is a Submariner port. So in Sunless Sea, of course, you had ports you could visit, which had every island had a story and some ties to other stories to other islands. When you go below the surface of the Z in your submarine, in our expansion, Submariner, you will find more ports with more stories. And I'm building an island in there right now called Hideaway.
Okay.
The city of refuge.
Actually, because we didn't really stop to explain Sunlissi properly. Just give them a quick overview.
So as Alexis mentioned earlier, Fallen London has been stolen by bats and deposited a mile underneath the ground in this strange neath underneath area. And there are many islands out there on the Z where the player can now sail. So in a Sunless Sea, you're a captain. You get your boat. You go out to all of these islands. You learn the intrigues, the tragedies, the farces, and you participate those. You impact those stories and those characters, and you...
So it's a finite game, and now you're just preparing an expansion coming up.
Correct.
And
it'll be played in more or less the same way with extra terrors as you go deep dark underground.
So we mentioned the building that we're in, which is a cool building at the beginning. But we're also very near the sea. And I just, as an American person, recently moved to London not that long ago.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit, all for all, and for the benefit of everybody listening, because we're in a beautiful area of London. I don't visit that often.
Pretty place, yes.
I mean, it's not London technically either, but...
It's not the city of...
But yeah, tell us about Greenwich.
Oh, Greenwich. It's a fine little place. We've only been here about a couple weeks. Before, we were in North Greenwich, quite near to Canary Wharf on the O2. But it's much more personal down here. There are all number of little shops around. There's a little pie shop where a kindly old Irishman comes out and tells his menu at you, and then you order to him directly. There's a strange little crystal shop, a pagan occult shop, across the street from him, next to, I think, Theater of Wine, and all sorts of charming little...
Yeah, so like we're right by the Thames River, and there's the...
The Cutty Sark.
The Cutty Sark, the Royal Maritime Museum.
And Greenwich University, of course. I pass through that every day and hear the...
Beautiful buildings.
It's wonderful.
And of course, Greenwich Mean Line, the line, where the, you know, zero time, basically. This is really badly said, but anyway, whatever. How are you finding London? How is it like to be in Europe?
I'm very happy here, in truth. There was precious little for me to do back home in Florida, but the world is open to me here. I have the whole of London at my doorstep. I can go into Europe for a pittance. I haven't done so yet, in fairness, but I'm making the most of my time here now.
Cool. So I usually finish with a few kind of cool down questions when I'm calling. The quick one I gave to Alexis, about ice cream, because there's always some ice cream related questions.
Ice cream for everyone.
Ice cream for everyone. So, I mean, just start with, like, do you have a favorite flavor?
Chocolate.
Chocolate?
Very simple man, yes.
Yeah. Any kind of specific chocolate? Or
just chocolate. If it's chocolate, I will most likely be quite pleased.
Cool. That might answer my other question that I sometimes ask, which is like, do you have a favorite food that would deserve to be made into an ice cream?
Not that would deserve to be made into an ice cream. No.
Really?
No,
even a weird one?
Even weird? I don't think a burger ice cream would be too really good.
Burger ice cream?
I don't think it'd work.
They did it as crisps.
Oh, did they now?
Chips, yeah.
Can't be helped.
I wonder how that would taste as an ice cream.
Shameful.
Yeah. My brother's a chef, so I sometimes put challenges to him, like, you're just trying to do that. So that might be, like, burger ice cream might be an interesting one. Because if you break it down to the constituent parts, you know, you got to have like a little bit of roast meat flavor, a bit of ketchup and mustard, a bit of gherkin.
For me, it's very simple. It's just cheese, meat, bun.
Cheese, meat, bun. Okay, ketchup too. That's the best burger.
That's best burger you'll ever have.
Okay.
It's a simple arrangement. It's like Mozart.
Yeah.
You know, you change one line, the whole structure falls.
Yeah. And some other lines of questions I asked, and I don't know how much you can talk to this, but the rest of my day job, I'm a marketing strategist. So I used to work with ad agencies. Mm. And do you have any favorite ads that come to mind, or favorite ads?
I was rather charmed quite recently by the one of the Stella Artois ads,
okay,
which was the retelling of the brewery. And I think it's just because they channeled an aesthetic quite well. Uh-huh. It was a bit Buster Keaton. I thought the fellow playing the founder looked strangely like him. And I just really like high aesthetic. So they had, you know, the powdered wigs and
yeah,
this man examining a painting he was selling to get the money to buy the brewery. And this wild-looking film. So I just thought it was beautiful, yes.
In the UK?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I'll have to look it up. I don't think I've seen that one. Mm-hmm. I'll look it up and I'll put the link in the show notes to the video.
Sure. All
right. And generally speaking, do you know much about how Fallen London grows and is communicated in terms... I'm guessing a lot of word of mouth, but getting new players on board, etc.
We have had great success with word of mouth.
Mm.
Hannah, our marketing director, has done wonderful work helping foster the community. And also, we do get ads out there as well. I think we've had a few playing out on Spotify and with the launch of the Sun of Sea app, the Fall of London app, excuse me. You know, a few ads out there which have created great attention, and it's a combination primarily, I think, of word of mouth and seeing it out there, recommended articles, etc.
Yeah.
I think one of our biggest drives was Extra Credits, who did a video about...
Is that a big YouTube channel for gaming? I don't know. Sorry.
Yes. Extra Credits is a wonderful channel. They do discussions about topics in gaming, and they once recommended Fall in London, and I think Felicia Day also once recommended Fall in London, and that was...
Yeah, that's also a great big driver.
To us, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So to finish things off, I will add the links to all the Failbiter games. People can just search for Fallen London on their iOS or the App Store, right?
It should be.
Yeah.
They find it. I think we're actually featured right now, so you may even see it.
Okay, cool.
You may even see it right there under the best new games. I think we're
fantastic.
Doing quite well with that.
And then the game itself in the browser is on fallenlondon.com, or what's the... fallenlondon.com. And you are... do you have any other writing available online, or do you...
Not
are
online,
you present,
but
or
hopefully. I am present on Twitter at the moment. I'm hoping to branch out shortly into other things.
What's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is simply Cash Decure. So
Cash
Decure, DECUIR.
Yeah, and Alexis Kennedy is at Alexis Kennedy, and Failbiter Games at Failbiter Games, right?
That's correct.
Cool. And so the expansion for Sunless Sea, is there a date for that or not yet?
I think we're saying right now third quarter, so sometime in the autumn.
So right now, mobile app for Fallen London is a big thing, and then if you're a fan or interested in Sunless Sea, there's going to be the expansion coming out.
It will be wonderfully distressing, I can guarantee you.
Fantastic. Cash, this was awesome. Thank you so much for coming and talking to me.
It's an absolute
pleasure. Well, I came here, but...
Well, of course. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, dear listeners. That's another episode wrapping up. Thank you so much for listening. Am I repeating myself? Listeners listening? Possibly. I'm trying things out. I don't know how should I be calling you? Ice cream fans? Ice cream fans. That's not bad. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it. And I keep repeating myself. But, you know, that's what it's all about, essentially. I'm really just doing it for your own pleasure and my own pleasure. I'm learning things at every new episode. But if you enjoyed it, I would just want more people to be listening to this. So how about sharing it with a friend? Just send them a link to the file. Even better, how about sharing it on your favorite social network? Just post that on Facebook, post it on Twitter, tell your other podcast enthusiasts that this podcast is out there and it's worth checking out. If you have any feedback, questions, comments, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me on Twitter. My Twitter name is @HippoWill. You can post a comment on the Ice Cream for Everyone page on Facebook. You can leave a review on your iPhone podcasting app, iTunes, wherever you listen to your podcast, once again. You can also send me an email. That's Willem, WILLEM, @icecreamforeveryone.net. And that's about it for now. Thank you again for listening. Till next time. Bye-bye.